And good morning to everybody. Our first case this morning is TransCanada Keystone Pipeline LP for route approval versus Donovan. We have 30 minutes scheduled for both sides for this argument, and because of our timing apparatus, you're going to have to tell us how you're going to allot that time, and you're going to have to police that yourselves, both sides. So with that, Mr. Domina, good morning to you. I should also note that the court will take a 10-minute break after this case before we proceed to the other cases of the day. Again, good morning to you, Mr. Domina. You may proceed.
Good morning, Your Honor. I'm Dave Domina. I'm here on behalf of the landowners. It's our intention as the collective group of appellants to use our 30 minutes as follows. 10 minutes by me for the landowners, 5 minutes each by the two tribal governments, 5 minutes by the Sierra Club, and if none of us use all of our time so the rebuttal swells, as we hope it will, I get the rebuttal for everyone.
Thank you very much.
So that's my objective. May it please the court, when the Nebraska legislature addressed the question of how a crude oil pipeline company should seek route authority, it chose to say that the governor of Nebraska had to speak before the Public Service Commission could speak. That statute, section 57-1405, constrains the Public Service Commission. It is a jurisdictional statute. In this case, the application of TransCanada Keystone XL Pipeline LP recites in numerous locations that the application for which authority is sought here was never denied by a governor, as that statute requires, but was approved by a governor. And that approval by the governor is in the application. The last page of that approval is signed by the governor of Nebraska, a letter that was sent to the president of the United States. It says, I approve the route. That approval had a 2-year shelf life, Your Honor, and after it expired, which is also recited in the application, there was never another attempt to return to the governor for an approval or a denial. So what we have historically is one approach to the governor, one approval by the governor, one expiration of that approval, no additional attempts, and most importantly, no denials.
Is this a jurisdictional argument that you raised before the Public Service Commission, and does that matter to our analysis?
First, it doesn't matter because this is a subject matter jurisdiction issue. Second, in each of our complaints in intervention, and we filed 3, we raised jurisdiction. In the third of those 3 complaints, we attempted to specify additional issues, and we were denied that opportunity when a motion to strike was sustained. If I remember the page number correctly, and I think I do, on page 5432 of the record, we filed a brief that cited this statute and recited this language. So we attempted to raise this issue. But even if we hadn't, it's a jurisdictional subject, and so it doesn't matter.
Is your ultimate argument that if you get approval from the governor, you do not have to go to the Public Service Commission?
No, Your Honor, that is not our ultimate argument. Our argument here is simply this. Without a denial, the Public Service Commission can't act. That's all. Now, the legislature
What would be the scope of a denial?
I think the scope of the denial would have to be outright, Your Honor. It would have to be an application that simply doesn't get approved by the governor. Now, if the governor were to say, I deny, but I'd consider something new, we'd have an issue that isn't before this court that we haven't addressed and that hasn't presented itself, so I can't really say what would happen there. But if the governor were to say, I approve, as happened here, then this statute is not activated, and what happens is that instead of that, construction is authorized.
And let me ask the same question. What's the scope of approval?
I think the scope of approval has to be an unconditional approval scope by the governor. Now, when the governor approves under 57-1405, he doesn't grant condemnation authority because that's compartmentalized off into section 57-1101. And so the series of statutes in chapter 57, article 14, is about construction authority, route and construction. Chapter 57, Article 11, is about condemnation. And I will add that they're not written with perfect clarity, but they were written by the legislature, and we take them as we have them. But it's clear there are two different subjects.
Do you have one without the other, or is it paramateria?
Your Honor, I've struggled with how to answer that question anticipating it, and I think the fairest way to answer it is to say that it's certainly in paramateria to the extent that the subject is crude oil pipelines. I think beyond that, it's very hard to say those subjects are in paramateria for this reason. We have all over the state, at the county level, the city level, and the state level, we have statutes that authorize land use but don't address condemnation. We have statutes that authorize condemnation that have nothing to do with land use or building permits. So we really have construction and authority to construct here and in this way. And then we have this separate subject of, well, if you can't get all the land you need to fill in the gaps and complete the project, we have condemnation authority.
Are those statutes harmonious? Can you read them harmoniously?
I think they can be read harmoniously. I think they can be. I think it's possible, Your Honor, that you could have either pre-existing authority to build a pipeline and only need condemnation authority under 5711, or you could be in a situation where you got construction authority, not applying for eminent domain authority at the same time, found that you needed it, and had to go back under 5711. That makes them harmonious.
Do the two statutes speak to each other in terms of the chronologic development of each of these factors?
No, they do not. They refer to one another, but they offer no clue about chronology.
Why can't 1405 Section 1 say that if a pipeline carrier is going to construct an oil pipeline and haven't received approval by the governor, they just can't start constructing it until they receive approval from the Service Commission? That's what the language seems. Why would that be?
Well, I think that reading's correct, and that is the essence of our point, Your Honor, and I think that's why we win this case on jurisdiction. Because without having permission to construct, which is what a route is about, route approval is the authority to construct here. That's what it is. And so I think that the court's interpretation of that is exactly correct. That's what it means, and that's why TransCanada and the Public Service Commission got ahead of themselves below. There simply isn't any jurisdiction. Now, in addition to all of that, they didn't apply for the route that the Public Service Commission approved. And that's equally clear from the application. The application's request for relief is closed with these words: wherefore, TransCanada Keystone XL Pipeline requests an order from the PSC that the preferred route is in the public interest, and that TransCanada is authorized to act pursuant to Section 57, and the citation is 1101.
How was the issue tried before the PSC?
The issue was tried on the application. The only route tried was the preferred route. There were many...
The PSC asked in advance for everyone to give evidence regarding the alternate routes, and included the opportunity to give an additional witness. Is that correct?
The PSC issued an order that said we encourage you to develop or present evidence concerning the mainline alternative.
Does that expand the application?
No, absolutely not. What it does is to say that the PSC was interested in why the mainline alternative wasn't the first preference and the applied for route. Now, the PSC had a way to get to the mainline alternative, but it didn't use it. The statute says if the PSC has jurisdiction and is hearing an application and doesn't want to approve it, it is to deny that application. And then the applicant has 60 days to file an amendment to meet the objections or substitute an alternative route.
What happens if it moves forward in that way? Is there another hearing, or does the commission just return and consider the new proposal on the...
The statute is unclear about that, Your Honor. I think the fairest reading of the statutes is that it's a matter of scope. If the amendment is minor, and it could be, but that's a denial is required even for a minor change, I think the PSC would probably be sustained by this court if it didn't convene another hearing. If there's a substituted route, I think there has to be a new hearing. There could be new persons to notify, in this case.
So you would argue that if that procedure was followed here, a new hearing required for evidence put on of the
of the mainline alternative. Yes, I would. And in that case here, there would be many people who got no notice the first time around who would be heard in that second hearing, as contrasted with, for example, including or excluding a pump station of a particular size, which could be another reason to turn it down and send them back with an amended application.
Let's start about notice for a minute. What notice was given by TransCanada or the PSC, the alternate route?
None, Your Honor, other than what was given for the preferred route. And that means that they published to the political subdivisions and in the locations where the preferred route was located.
Who did that?
The commission did under the statute.
Did the commission also give notice to the counties and metropolitans within the area
of
the alternate route?
The Department of Environmental Quality solicited some of them for opinions, as is required by the statute. There were notices published in some, but not all, of those communities, because there's some coincidence of communities on the two routes, but otherwise the answer is no. Thank you.
Thank you.
Your Honor, this is Brad Jolly for the Ponca Tribe of Nebraska.
Good morning, Mr. Jolly.
The Ponca Tribe is a government, and the PSC violated its rules and the APA when it limited the tribe to just social and cultural issues. Both the PSC's rules and the APA say that an intervener can participate to the full extent of the interest expressed in its petition.
Where is the right to intervene? In the statute, or is it in regulation? Where is that?
It's actually in both. The APA says you can intervene, and actually this court is the APA. I'm sorry, I don't have the exact number. It is in our brief, though.
So the APA is applied by the PSC?
I would say that the PSC's rules actually sort of implement the APA. And I think there's some questions whether they expand some of the rights allowed under the APA or not. We think they do. But in the case
that's part of the argument for the Ponca Tribe, is that correct?
Well, I think actually beyond that, the Ponca Tribe actually did assert other interests. From the first sentence all the way to the next page and a half, it talks about its governmental interests. It's like a half a page on cultural resources. But the PSC said, well, we don't care about your governmental interests. We're going to relegate this government down to just social cultural issues. And
does the tribe own any real estate in the affected areas?
The tribe, actually, Congress has said, with the MAR in particular, we have five counties where the tribe is considered to be, and its members to be, on or near reservation. And so, for example, the MAR is going through Madison County, right by the tribe's courts, one of its clinics, its transportation facility, everything. All of its governmental offices are right there. One of its governmental headquarters is right there now for the MAR. But we didn't get to be heard on any of those things. The tribe has an MOA, or a mutual aid agreement with the state of Nebraska for emergencies. We didn't get to be heard on that. Elkhorn and Logan Valley, we have agreements for public health emergencies, contagious diseases, and, for example, what happened in one of the so-called man camps. We didn't get to be heard on any of that. Nothing. We were told, no, you can't talk about that. You can only talk about these social and cultural issues. Tribe has environmental department.
Under the APA, did the PSC have the authority to limit intervention?
No, there's nothing that says that they can limit an intervener to just some of their interests. It says they shall be allowed to participate with respect to all of the interests expressed in the petition, is what the APA says. And we did express those interests in the petition. But the PSC still said, no, you can't hear that. And that, as an interested party, the tribe had constitutional due process rights. The right to be heard on all of its interests, not just what the PSC thought it could relegate it to.
Council, I'm sorry to interrupt. I want to go back to the question that was asked a moment ago. So the Public Service Commission has regulations that govern intervention.
Right. Yes.
That's a given. But what I'm interested in hearing from you is your perspective on whether MOPSA, whether the statute itself, contemplates intervention in the approval process that it sets out. And if you see it there somewhere, I'd like to be directed to it.
You know, I believe that I think MOPSA is supposed to be read, I think, with the APA. It's as an agency proceeding. Those rules would apply. And I think MOPSA does contemplate that. I mean, certainly I think in having interested parties intervene, by providing notice in all of the counties and municipalities where, you know, that's what an applicant's supposed to do, provide notice, service on the counties, goes a notice in all the counties, municipalities where the pipeline's gonna run. That's so people in those counties can come in and intervene. So I think it is contemplated.
I beg your pardon, have you addressed what you would have said or offered?
Well, yeah, like I said, we have, you know, an environmental department that this could impact. The tribe's health services, it's the primary healthcare provider for all natives in all of those counties.
Is there an offer of proof made regarding what evidence would have been presented but was clear from doing so?
We did file a motion to reconsider and said, hey, these are the interests. We have the same interest. We have natural resources. We have environmental department. We have the health services. All of these things, they were put in there, and we were denied on that reconsideration. But other than that, every time we tried to go beyond cultural resources, we were told, no, you can't say anything. But that was prior to the hearing, so it wasn't a formal offer of proof. It was just a motion to reconsider. Now, when we look at the application, it's clear on its face, it only sought approval of the MAR, or of the preferred route, I'm sorry. The MAR, they never said we want approval. It doesn't even have the items required by MOPSA for the MAR. And this court's...
Mr. Donovan, there was a lot of evidence about the MAR, a lot of questioning. Is that correct?
Yes, there was some. And in particular, a lot of those questions were that there's no information on the MAR, were the answers.
Landowners simply asked some of the experts in Canada, isn't the MAR better? Isn't it more beneficial for Nebraska? Weren't those questions asked?
And they were asked, but I think that was for, you know, MOPSA requires that the PSC, look at other routes for comparison. And I think that people were talking about the MAR in terms of that comparison. And I think, as landowners pointed out, and that's the tribe's position, is if you want to approve that MAR, what you've got to do is deny the application and then allow an amended application to come in for that new round.
I believe
the Despanco tribe, I think, well, we did not believe that they were looking at approving the MAR. We believe that if they just wanted evidence for comparison purposes.
Exactly.
But actually, on the motion to reconsider, we made that exact argument.
Well,
yes.
There's some arguments that the MAR is better. That was what should be approved.
The Ponca tribe did not make that argument. We argued that neither route should have ever been approved. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Good morning. You are?
Good morning. My name is Jennifer Baker, and I represent, along with my co-counsel, Leonica Charging Davison, the Yankton Sioux tribe, which is a government and a sovereign Indian nation.
Good morning, Ms. Baker.
Good morning. I'd like to start at the outset by stating that the tribe at no point ever argued or suggested that the PSC should approve an alternative route. That was a misstatement in a certain brief, and we wanted to make sure that that was clarified. The tribe never asked for any alternative route, not the MAR or any of the other ones. Also, I'd like to point out that this case is not about the lesser of two evils, as the PSC and the TransCanada might lead you to believe. It's not about the lesser of two evils, but it's about the public interest of Nebraska. And as the other parties and the tribe itself has demonstrated through briefing, TransCanada failed to meet its burden of proof that the pipeline route, or any route for the pipeline, is in the public interest. The tribe identified 17 errors in its brief, and due to time constraints and overlap, will address errors 4 and 11 through 14. Error 4 concerns the burden of proof regarding cultural resources and public interest, which are part of the social impacts of the pipeline and therefore part of the public interest. So these cultural resources and their protection needed to be taken into account and considered in the PSC's decision on whether the pipeline route was in the public interest.
Council, are you making the argument that there is no conceivable route that could be in the public interest?
No, Your Honor, I'm not.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you. TransCanada relied on the programmatic agreement as evidence regarding cultural resources. This is basically the only evidence they put on. The programmatic agreement is an agreement between several United States agencies, several different state agencies, and TransCanada itself about how cultural resources will be treated, the surveys that will be completed, because to date, those surveys are not yet completed.
What could they have done in advance? Surveys of all the possible routes?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Without surveys and the results of those surveys, there's insufficient evidence for the PSC to make a determination about how those resources would be harmed. They don't know what's there, so they don't know what harm could happen.
Are there steps in place if they discover archaeological facts or items that are important to the tribe?
There are, Your Honor, and those steps, however, are not only insufficient, but there was part of the programmatic agreement, which is, like I said, it's an agreement between state agencies, the United States and TransCanada, but tribes were not a party to that. They did not have input in that process. They don't have all of the rights that are available to other signatories to that because they are not signatories.
They were not conducted, or not consulted about any of this?
That is a kind of a complicated issue, but this, the United States would argue that they engaged in consultation. The tribes would argue that they absolutely failed at consultation. There was nothing meaningful about it, which is the standard under federal law.
This is done by the Department of State?
Yes.
They sought requests from the tribe, or they did not seek any requests from the tribe?
There was a series of correspondence. There may have been a meeting, but nothing meaningful, nothing where the tribe could actually put forth all of the information that the United States needed in order to make a determination about what should go into this agreement.
Programmatic agreement that goes forward from here, if they find items of cultural importance, contact the tribe, or what's the process intended to be?
Well, the process is intended to be that construction would cease if something was encountered that they believed to be a cultural resource protected under the programmatic agreement, and the state historic preservation officer, or SHPO, would be contacted, the tribes would be contacted, and the State Department would be contacted, and then there would be a determination made about how to proceed from there. But the biggest point I'd like to make with respect to this programmatic agreement is that it does not apply to the mainline alternative route. It's a site-specific agreement. It, and if I could bear with me for 1 second. The PA defines proposed project as construction of approximately 875 miles of new crude oil pipeline in the United States as described in section 2.1 of the FSEIS. And it defines the area of potential effect in Nebraska as a corridor in areas consistent with the route evaluated in the FEIS for the 2008 KXL application. The mainline alternative route, therefore, is outside the scope of this agreement, and as that was the only evidence that was put forth on protection of cultural resources as part of the public interest, it's insufficient, and the TransCanada has failed to meet its burden of proof here. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Winston, good morning to you.
Good morning. Kenneth Winston, on behalf of the Nebraska Sierra Club. May it please the court, the Public Service Commission's decision to approve the mainline alternative appears to be an attempt at a political compromise. However, the PSC's decision is wrong both legally and factually. I'm going to lay out three brief reasons why the PSC's order is wrong. First of all, they failed to make specific findings of fact and conclusions of law as required by Nebraska Revised Statute 84-915. Secondly,
what was lacking?
There were no findings of facts. There were no conclusions of law. We don't know whether there's no statement that TransCanada met its burden of proof. Absolutely none. So they failed dismally in that. In the Yellow Cab case, this court held that failing to make findings of fact and conclusions of law is irregular and will be set aside on appeal. So therefore, it's our position that this order should be set aside.
Since our standard of review is de novo in this matter, how does that affect your argument?
Well, the fact that they failed to do that, according to my reading of that case, this order should be set aside and handed back for further proceedings by the Public Service Commission rather than just having the court. Well, I guess I would yield to the arguments that the landowners previously made about the lack of jurisdiction in this case.
The remedy for your alleged failure to make findings of fact and conclusions of law is to remand this for such findings on the existing record?
Yes. Well, to remand it for further proceedings. As I indicated, we also support what the landowners say, and we believe there's a lack of jurisdiction and should be remanded. The case should be dismissed and remanded, and whatever happens at that point would be up to TransCanada. Okay, then the second point is that TransCanada failed to meet its burden of proof for any route. Then the third issue is the issue which has previously been discussed about the rules of intervention, which states that a party is entitled to present evidence to the extent of its interest. And there's specific case law. The rule is Title 21, 291, Chapter 1, Rule 15.01, which specifically states that a party is entitled to present evidence to the extent of its interest, and this court has upheld that standard in the case Jansen versus Diller, and specifically said that the PSC has to follow that rule regarding intervention. And it specifically quotes that statute. Also, the question was asked about whether this was contemplated in this case, and the rules adopted pursuant to MOPSA, specifically Rule 23.06, states that the conduct of the hearing, filing petitions for intervention, shall be governed by the rules of commission procedure. And there's a specific statute governing the way that the rules of procedure are to be adopted. That statute is Nebraska Revised Statute 75-110. So based upon that, the APA should not have been applied, and they should have used their own rules in this case. And then I guess the other thing I just wanted to talk a little bit about regarding the burden of proof. It appears to us that the mainline alternative was a straw man. Nobody favored it. TransCanada did not favor it. No one supported the mainline alternative. The burden of proof cannot be met based upon the mainline alternative. So no one, since there was no evidence on that subject, it could not have been, they could not have met their burden of proof. There also was a failure to provide evidence on several key elements, in specifically property rights and aesthetic values, addressing the impacts of water resources or social impacts. And I believe that my time has elapsed, and I would ask that any additional time be reserved for rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Lopez, good morning to you.
Good morning, Mr. Chief Justice. Just as a housekeeping note, at the beginning of the hearing, you noted that both sides had 30 minutes total, but in our earlier order, we understood the appellees to have 20. I just wanted to clarify, do we have 30 between us and the company, or 20?
No, you have 20. I'm sorry, I mistook that.
Okay, I'll proceed under that understanding. Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court, I first want to advise the court as to how the appellees intend to tackle the issues today. We have 20 minutes, which I will divide equally with Mr. Powers. He, on behalf of the company, will address the commission's public interest determination, the details of that determination, and the evidentiary record that supports it. I, on behalf of the commission, intend to address the jurisdictional challenge to the commission's authority to act at all, and the commission's authority to select the mainline alternative route. Time permitting, I will try to address some of the challenges regarding an applicant's burden when coming to the commission for a major oil pipeline application. Turning to the jurisdictional challenge, the premise of this challenge is that because the application was not preceded by a gubernatorial denial of it, that the jurisdiction the jurisdiction of the Public Service Commission was lacking. This is premised on an argument advanced for the first time on appeal that 1405 sub 1 requires gubernatorial approval as a condition precedent, as the appellants themselves characterize it, before the PSC can act.
Mr. Lopez,
yes?
If the premise was correct, I understand you don't agree with the premise. If the premise was correct, it doesn't matter when it was first advanced.
Justice Castle, that's correct. If it is truly a subject matter jurisdictional argument, then I would not contest that they could raise it for the first time on appeal. As we have said in our brief, we're characterizing it as a conditions precedent argument. The company has characterized it as an invited error argument. I think either one of those would get you to the same place. But I will not take issue with your principle that if it's a subject matter jurisdiction argument, it's still preserved. That said, I think the jurisdictional arguments are pretty well set out by the briefs, and I'll instead try to address the jurisdictional argument on its merits. On those merits, it fails for three reasons. First, it's foreclosed by this court's interpretation of the function of the statutory scheme here and the choices that an applicant faces. Second, it's inconsistent with the underlying constitutional and statutory authority that the commission has in considering a major oil pipeline application. And third, it would produce the absurd result that an entire subset of pipelines could never be built in Nebraska. Let me address those in turn. First of all, Thompson versus Heineman forecloses the argument. In that case, a majority of this court said what the law is as it pertains to the regulatory choices that a major oil pipeline applicant has. And you could not have been more clear. You said that the legislature, quote, enacted regulatory choices for carriers. You said a carrier, quote, has two choices. Governor approval, quote, or to go through the approval process under MOPSA with the PSC. You said that TransCanada specifically and all other major oil pipeline carriers benefited from this procedural choice. So I think, at least for this purpose, Thompson versus Heineman is at best a decision of this court on the function and regulatory and procedural choices that an applicant has between either going to the governor or to the PSC. And Justice Papik, I think your question touched on this, that you can read 1405 sub 1 to essentially say that going straight to the PSC is possible just in the absence of having gone to the governor. It's not truly a condition precedent. But in any event, in the very worst case scenario, Thompson versus Heineman is very persuasive dicta given its recency as to this regulatory choice. So I think for that reason alone, the jurisdictional argument is without merit.
What does 571101 say?
571101 actually strengthens our argument even more. And this dovetails with how you have to read MOPSA in tandem with the eminent domain authorization statute. 571101 has an or between gubernatorial approval or the MOPSA process under the PSC. So reading 571101 in tandem with MOPSA, you have an even stronger statutory indicator that the legislature intended for there to be a regulatory or procedural choice.
The landowner's position is that the governor has approved 1405. Does 1405 say anything about what happens at the approval?
Well, to the extent that it could even be read to, it doesn't matter because that approved pipeline, as the court pointed out during the landowner's argument, the clock has expired for them to exercise their eminent domain authority under 571101, so it doesn't matter.
What was approved? What was the scope of the approval?
In the earlier pipeline? Well, Justice Miller-Lerman, again, it doesn't matter because their clock has run out on the eminent domain authority anyway, so they still had to come back and get another permit, and that's what they've done here through the PSC.
And at some point in these proceedings, I'm jumping ahead, TransCanada filed an application to a motion to amend its application.
Right.
Why?
What
would they offer? What amendments would have obtained?
And this jumps to our second argument, which is the authority of the PSC to approve the mainline alternative route and make a finding that that route was in the public interest, which is their statutory obligation to do. They approved that based on the fact that that route was within the application submitted to the PSC by TransCanada. And you don't have to take my word for it. All of my friends on the other side have indicated the same. The landowner's closing argument is replete with comparisons between the preferred route and the mainline alternative route and how the latter is superior. And I would add, just as a housekeeping note, the record that supports this, particularly the transcript, is electronic and easily searchable. I would urge the court to ask your clerks to simply do control F searches for certain buzzwords to show where the appellants specified that they were discussing the mainline alternative route. The landowners indicated that it is within.
That's a little different than my question is with respect to the motion to amend the application.
Well, at the end, and I'll allow Mr. Powers to sort of clarify what their purpose in submitting that motion to amend. But from the commission's perspective, they were simply trying to clarify that indeed that was to belt and suspenders the principle that the mainline alternative route would have been what was their preferred route.
Right.
Right.
Is that right? That's
correct.
You all's position. It was encompassed.
It was. So Justice Miller-Lerman, they didn't need to do that. Either under the commission's view or as a matter of law under MOPSA, or indeed in the now abandoned views of my friends on the other side. And just to continue with some of these indications from the record in terms of what the parties viewed as there having been as the state of the constellation of routes that had been proposed. The landowner said, "It is within your power to approve the alternate route." That's a T-6011. Quote, "Two proposed routes are advanced," referring to the preferred route and the mainline alternative. That's a T-6012. "The application should be denied, but if it is approved, it should be the mainline route with conditions." That's also at 6012.
At what point did the application come to encompass more than one route? There from the beginning, or did that happen by virtue of something the PSC did?
Justice Papik, I think it was there at the beginning. I think that's very obvious in terms of the routes that they included. And they included these alternative routes in compliance with the statutory requirement that they include in the application consideration of alternative routes. And that's consistent with the other statutory indicators we have that the commission possesses the authority to decide the routing.
Were the notices given to all the right folks with respect to the MAR?
They certainly were. So this brings me to the second part of Justice Papik's question, and Justice Miller-Lerman, I think it answers your question. Even if it wasn't clear at the beginning when the application came in, it was abundantly clarified when the commission took control of the situation and aligned and organized the proceedings in its intervention order. And the intervention order is very important on this point because it clarified that the commission viewed there as having been multiple routes proposed: the Sandhills route, which they rejected, the mainline alternative route, and the preferred route. They ordered the development of evidence on it. They provided for the interveners to participate on both of those routes. They allowed for additional witness participation on the mainline alternative route. And there's an entire section at the end of that intervention order.
So you're echoing Justice Funk's question from earlier with respect to orders that were given as to the scope of evidence to be received.
It relates, yes. Okay. Yes, Justice Miller-Lerman. And it relates back to Justice Papik's question, which is, at what point was the MAR really a proposed route?
What notices were given as a result of that intervention? Any additional notices?
Counties and local governmental subdivisions, including cities, were. And I want to correct one of the arguments from before. There was an argument that the notices given to the letters sent to the municipal governments along the mainline alternative route were not given notice by the PSC. That is wrong. I would draw the court's attention to the part of the record beginning at T-990, where you have the series of letters that were sent to all of the governmental subunits at the intervention order stage. The ones that went to the mainline alternative subunits specifically discussed the mainline alternative route, made reference to the application, even gave a URL to the PSC's website that contained the route. So
what notice was given to landowners on the alternative route?
Well, MOPSA doesn't require specific and actual notice to every conceivable entity along a route. What it requires is general publication in a newspaper of general circulation, the governmental subunit notice that was provided below. And I think, and I'll close on this point, Your Honor, because I do want to yield on time to my co-counsel, Mr. Powers. The fact of the adequacy of the notice is illustrated by the fact that these appellants are here. The Ponca tribe, for example, would not have been entitled under any reading of any part of the statute to specific notice, and yet they were able to come in and intervene and participate. No one else showed up after the intervention order saying that somehow they hadn't received notice and that they needed to be afforded leave to participate behind some deadline or anything else like that. So I think it's very clear from the record that notice was adequate, particularly after the PSC provided notice to these other entities after the intervention order. The commission asked this court to affirm the decision. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Powers, good morning to you.
Good morning. May it please the court, Jim Powers, along with Patrick Pepper, here on behalf of TransCanada Keystone Pipeline, seeking affirmance of the Public Service Commission's order approving the mainline alternative for the construction of the pipeline. At the very beginning of this argument, I'd just like to touch on the standard that we think is applicable. Justice Stacey already talked about it's a de novo standard. We think it's a standard, though, that should give some deference to the constitutionally entrusted decision of the Public Service Commission to determine what is in the public interest.
Is this an argument that the statute that says the standard of review, OBO, is unconstitutional?
It's not an argument that that statute's unconstitutional. I think this court can interpret that review in keeping with that statute. I think it did recently in the application number B, 1829 case, involving a common carrier. In that case, the court held that the reviewed the evidence of the record, found the there was evidence sufficient to support the finding of the court, and therefore no error. I think the standard should be this court should review the evidence, and if there's a rational basis in the evidence to support the finding of the Public Service Commission, it should be affirmed. I don't think this court should attempt to substitute its judgment for the judgment of the Public Service Commission, because it could violate the separation of powers.
So the statute says de novo, but we construed de novo to mean deference, avoid a constitutional problem?
Well, I think it's consistent that you can do that without raising the constitutional issue. And I think this court has. And I think that the court has to be careful not to go down that path. But regardless, if it's a standard that I've just advocated or the traditional de novo on record, we think the record absolutely supports an affirmance of the PSC's decision.
And I'd like clarification on what level of deference you are suggesting.
It's a deference.
Use of discretion, clear error, what? Which of our various deferential standards are you suggesting we look to?
I think it's a standard that if the decision is rationally based on the record, review the record and make it determine if it's rationally based upon the, if there's evidence in the record that supports the finding of the Public Service Commission, that standard should be, or that decision should be affirmed.
The rational basis standard, and you got that standard from where?
Well, that's a standard that's used in federal cases involving agency determinations, but I think the standard can
Are you echoing the APA, the Administrative Procedure Act?
I am not, okay. With that, Your Honor. I think under either standard, this decision should be affirmed, because under the, I'd like to move to the burden of proof. We've heard arguments from the appellants that Keystone did not meet its burden of proof in this case. These arguments misconstrue the burden of persuasion versus the burden of production. Keystone was not required to produce each and every element, every factor that the PSC is required to consider pursuant to MOPSA. The PSC is required to make its determination based upon the entire record, all the evidence. And if the greater weight of that evidence supports the finding of what's in the public interest, it should make that. It can't just rely on the evidence that's supplied by Keystone. That doesn't mean to say that Keystone didn't supply evidence of the mainline alternative route. Any indication of that in the arguments is not supported by the record.
You referenced a greater, I'm sorry, Judge.
Go ahead.
You referenced a greater weight of the evidence. Is there a quantum of proof component in MOPSA anywhere?
No. Just the MOPSA says that Keystone has the burden to persuade, to come forward, and the Public Service Commission shall make its finding.
What quantum of proof do you believe they applied here?
Greater than the evidence, it was greater than the greater standard. The evidence was, the record and the evidence showed by a greater weight of the evidence that the mainline alternative was in the public interest. And back to the point why it's not, the burden can't solely be on Keystone, is the statute itself requires the PSC to consider factors that are not in Keystone's control. Specifically, the PSC has considered the opinions and comments from the governing bodies along the route. They're also to consider state agency reports, 9 state agencies. These are things that Keystone could not ever have brought forward to the attention of the commission. And then with the particular to the elements of that are required to be considered, the compliance with law is the first element. Keystone provided ample evidence that would comply with the law. The construction mitigation, again, Keystone provided had CMR construction mitigation reclamation plan in place, state of the art, and that would apply wherever the pipeline would be built. The social and economic impact, was the evidence was there. The Public Service Commission said there might be a dispute to the extent of the amount of economic impact, but it certainly will have an economic impact wherever it's built. And the use of utility corridors, that became an important factor, I think, in the Public Service Commission's decision. They determined, in fact, that's a factor there to consider, and that's what probably was one of the parts that led to the utility corridor. An orderly development, Keystone provided evidence on the mainline alternative route that the land is mostly agricultural in nature and would remain agricultural in nature, and therefore would not impede the orderly development of the land. And finally, with respect to the environmental impact of the pipeline, Keystone provided a great deal of evidence on its table 2.1 of the application that would show the impact on endangered and threatened species, the hydrology, soil, water crossings, irrigation crossings. All that information was in the is in the record and showed the impact of the mainline alternative route. Any argument or any assertion that you've heard today that there was no evidence concerning the mainline alternative route is just wrong. The record is replete with evidence that shows a mainline alternative route, the impact on it. In fact, the PSC, I think, was made its decision in part based upon the evidence that was offered by the natural resources interveners. As you heard, the PSC, when it issued its order on intervention, offered all the parties a chance to bring additional witnesses and evidence on the mainline alternative. The landowners conducted discovery on the mainline alternative. Environmental interveners went forward and brought in two experts, and those experts concluded that the mainline alternative would have less impact than the preferred route. By doing that, they certainly knew, one, what was that the mainline alternative route was in play, and two, the PSC considered that evidence. So finally, on this point, I think it goes back that the PSC has a duty to consider all the evidence, including the reports of the state agencies. The NDEQ determined there would be no, the mainline alternative route would have very no environmental impact, minimal environmental impact. So when looked at all the factors, the PSC reached its decision. It's not just the decision that was the information supplied by Keystone. That's what most is.
Can I ask you a question I've asked other presenters? And that was, is it correct that TransCanada filed a motion to amend the application?
TransCanada filed, I think, a motion for a new trial. And in that, they asked whether they should, if there was any need to amend its application. We did that solely to confirm that whether we needed to or not. And the Public Service Commission was very clear, said that was not necessary, and we stand behind that decision, and we believe the mainline alternative route was correctly or rightfully approved and took no further action on that. We're ready. We told the commission at that hearing we were ready to proceed on the mainline alternative intended to.
Thank you.
With respect to the power of the PSC to take on the mainline alternative, I think we just have to look to the statute. It's titled, it's a siting act. It's there to give the commission, under its plenary power, the right to determine the location of the pipeline. We were required to submit alternate routes in the pipeline. We submitted three routes. We thought they were all viable. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Do we have time for rebuttal?
5 minutes and 7 seconds.
5 minutes and 7 seconds, Mr. Domina.
May it please the court, these things are clear. No governor denied the route. The Public Service Commission is authorized under 57-1405 to act after a governor denies a route. That is not a condition precedent to jurisdiction any more than any act by the legislature is a condition precedent to authorizing an adjudicative body in Nebraska to adjudicate. If the PSC's authority isn't found in the Constitution all by itself, it doesn't exist. And in order to find out whether that's true, we would have to know whether the legislature preempted this area or did not, and we don't have that issue before this court.
What did we say in Thompson v. Heineman?
In Thompson versus Heineman, Your Honor, number one, you tied on the question of whether standing was a constitutional issue. So everything after that is dicta. There is no holding. Beyond that, what you said is that there were two routes to get the authority to exercise eminent domain under Section 571101, because that was the issue in Thompson versus Heinemann. This is a 571405 case under a different article of the statute. This issue was not addressed in Thompson versus Heinemann, and that case is not authority for anything. On the question of burden of proof, Section 571407(4) says that the applicant has the burden of proof. It doesn't quantify whether it's the greater weight, clear and convincing, or beyond a reasonable doubt. There is no expression of what that burden must be.
Can we tell from the record what quantum of proof the commission?
I don't think we can, Your Honor. I don't think we can. I don't think that it matters on de novo review if you have jurisdiction to engage in that review. My position here, as you know, is that you don't even reach de novo review because since the PSC lacked jurisdiction, of course you lack it as well. You can't get it unless the tribunal below had it. You also can't exceed the application in this court on de novo review. The application constrains you on de novo review just like it did the commission. You de novo review, for example, petitions or complaints for dissolution of marriage. And if there's no request for relief in that petition for dissolution of marriage that seeks legal separation, you can't grant it.
But if the parties expand the record before the trial court in a dissolution action, what would our review be if that expanded?
I'm pressing my imagination to understand how you'd expand to get away from a divorce to a legal separation, but I think you'd have to move to amend the pleadings. And in this case, the only attempt to amend the pleadings came after the fact. Before that, the cover page of this document says, TransCanada, pursuant to the Major Oil Pipeline Siting Act, not the constitutional authority of the PSC, seeks approval of the preferred route as defined in this application. And that's how the thing is signed on the signature page as well.
MOPSA
there was
doesn't
no
speak in terms of
pardon me.
Preferred routes, though, does it? MOPSA speaks in terms of proposed routes.
You know,
so how do those two concepts interrelate here?
Well, that tells me TransCanada can't read the statute. Because if they could, they would have called their route by the correct name. And they didn't. And the fact that they called it by the wrong name doesn't make their application broader. You're right. There's no such thing as a preferred route in the statute. They simply gave it that name for the horse race. But they did not apply for two or three routes. The statute does not permit them to apply for two or three routes. Their application didn't do it. There was never a motion for a leave to amend these pleadings. There was none of that.
What's the purpose of the alternate routes in the application?
Simply to inform the Department of Environmental Quality, if it's examining, and the Public Service Commission that there has been a comprehensive inquiry about what's in the best interest of Nebraska, Your Honor. In other words, the idea is not get glossed over with the idea that you're going to make so much money on your project that you only look at one place to do it. Take a broader look at Nebraska and show us that you've done it. But that doesn't make for...
Merely a comparison.
But not
now,
an alternative.
It's not an alternative. Now, if the PSC were to say, you know what, your first alternative's better, then they deny the application, not approve it, and then the applicant can think it over for 60 days and decide whether to reapply. That didn't happen here. TransCanada came in riding one horse. That's all. It got no votes for that horse. It lost. It loses here, too. Thank you.
Thank you very much. As noted, the court will take a 10-minute recess before we hear the remaining cases of the day.